In the new book, Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause, former soldier and head of the West Point History Department, Ty Sigley challenges the myths and lies of the Confederate legacy and explores why some of this country's oldest wounds have never healed. Ty Sigley is professor emeritus of history at West Point, where he taught for two decades. He served in the U.S. Army for 36 years, retiring as a brigadier general. He is the Chamberlain Fellow at Hamilton College, as well as New America Fellow. And again, the name of the new book is Robert E. Lee and Me, and it is a great honor to welcome Ty Sigley to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
I so appreciate you being here. This book is remarkable, and as is your story, and I thank you very much for being with us to share it. Let us talk about this reckoning that you had and the long time in coming. But ultimately, it begins, I mean, there is your life and how you were brought up as a Southerner and the reverence that you have for Robert E. Lee. And the way I have heard you describe this is that on a scale from 1 to 10, Robert E. Lee was an 11 and Jesus Christ was a 5. So that tells you a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It means it was reverential. I can't remember life without Robert E. Lee. That's what it is. My first book, first movies, every part of my things that his picture was in my house growing up, everything about my life made him a deity. And in fact, you know, I learned the words to Dixie, you know, the Southern anthem, which is a horrible thing. I mean, it actually talks about the good times of the slave era before I learned the Star Spangled Banner. So I wanted to be a Southern Christian gentleman, and the hero to be the first to emulate was really Robert E. Lee. So yeah, I totally grew up believing that Lee was the finest, not only the finest general who ever lived, but the finest man.
So ultimately, it is coming to West Point that changed that. As you look around and see how Robert E. Lee is represented on the campus of West Point.
There's a couple things that happened before that. One is I just been in the Army for so long.
Right.
My identity wasn't as a Southern gentleman. It was an Army officer, and I'd been married. And my wife, who's the hero of this book, is the person that really helped me set my sights straight. But as I was walking, our barracks are named after America's greatest heroes. So I went by Eisenhower Barracks and then Pershing Barracks and Grant Barracks. And finally, there was a sign for Lee, and it said, you know, Robert E. Lee Barracks. And I wondered, why are there so many things named after Lee? And I went all over campus, and there were like more than a dozen things named after him. And I wanted to know why. So I went into the archives, and it turns out in the first part of in the 19th century, from 1865 to 1898, the Confederates were banished. They were seen as traitors, none in the cemetery, none in our memorial hall, none in the monuments. And so then I went, well, that's weird. They didn't come back together immediately. When were those things put up? And it turns out that they were put up in 1930, 1950, 1970 as a reaction to integration. Scratch a Confederate monument and you find a paean to white supremacy or an argument against equal rights. And that just tore me up and made me change my complete way of thinking and led me ultimately to write this book.
Those actions done in the 30s, 50s, 70s, and in the intervening years, so they're conscious efforts. Those are not mistakes or lapses in judgment. Those are conscious efforts of white supremacy.
Absolutely. So in the 1930s, the first black cadet comes back to West Point after a 50-year absence. Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., one of my great heroes. He's the one that led the Red Tails during World War II, the Tuskegee Airmen. First general officer in the Air Force. I mean, just a tremendous soldier. And he was silenced during his time at West Point because he was black. No one talked to him. It was like a form of torture. And yet, while he was there, that's when we bring Lee portraits in. I lived on Lee Road by Lee Gate and Lee Housing Area. Those were named when he was there. In 1951, they bring this huge portrait of Robert E. Lee to West Point in Confederate gray, and it's a reaction to integrating the Army. The Army fought integration after Truman ordered it in 1948. They fight it And it's only the Korean War that really forces integration. So that's a reaction. And in 1970, when they named Lee Barracks, the sign I told you about, that's a reaction to bringing minority admissions. And we had only a handful of black cadets prior to that. But starting in 1969-70, we bring dozens a year. And so every time I found these Confederate monuments, it's either a reaction to integration purposefully, or it's saying that black people are not equal to white people, which is what those Confederates are monuments are in the South. So it's deeply racist, we just shouldn't tolerate it in the U.S. military, I believe.
Were there voices of opposition at the time?
Absolutely, but there were absolutely voices. There were black voices of opposition, but we have to remember is that the South was a racial police state, a one-party racial police state, and the segregationist congressman, this was the Democratic Party at the time, controlled everything. And to get anything done in the House or Senate, you had to appease these Senate and congressional Democrats who were from the South, who stayed in power forever because black people didn't have the votes. So if you think about this, you think about these Confederate monuments, black disenfranchisement, lynching, Confederate memorialization, these are all the pillars of a white supremacist society and that are there to keep a racial hierarchy with whites in political power.
Ty Sigley is the author of the new book, Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. So when it comes to that myth of the lost cause, you write about this extensively in the book, but tell us about that myth and how it got started.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. So if you think about that, the South went to war to preserve and expand slavery. They had this vision of taking slavery into Cuba, Puerto Rico, Latin America, South America, out west. And that's what they want to do is expand slavery. And they didn't just lose that, but with the 13th Amendment ending slavery, the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal rights, the 15th Amendment guaranteeing citizenship to all men, what they lost was their entire racial hierarchy. So really, went before the smoke clears the battlefield, this idea of why they fought and it changes. And Robert E. Lee is the one that really starts it by saying this war, we lost this war just because the North had all these immigrants and they had black soldiers and they had more money and materiel. Well, no, that's one part of this lost cause. That's not true. The North won, and I don't call it the North. I call it the United States of America. The U.S. Army won because it was the best fighting force on the globe, and it had to go into the South and defeat multiple armies simultaneously in an area larger than modern France and Germany, twice the size of that. So that's one. The second part of that myth is that the war wasn't fought. The war was not fought over slavery. Well, this is just wrong. We can read the secession documents, the cornerstone speech that the vice president of the Confederacy made. They clearly fought this war for slavery. Another part of that myth was that enslaved people were happy and it was the best labor system for both races. Well, this is just monstrous. Slavery featured rape, the lash, torture, murder, and the worst thing for enslaved families, selling families apart for profit. This myth said that Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, the great general, was a butcher and a drunk and not a good general, which is false. I believe he was the finest soldier ever to wear U.S. Army blue. And another part of that myth was that post-war Reconstruction, where the United States went into the South to create a biracial democracy or tried, and then it was overturned by white political violence in the South, that this was a failure because black people weren't ready for the vote or high office. Also a lie, 2,000 black men served in high office during that time. And then the top of that lost cause myth was that Robert E. Lee was the finest man who ever lived, the finest general, the finest warrior that ever lived. Well, the one problem with that is he didn't just lose. His armies were destroyed. I mean, no one has lost a war as completely as the South lost that war. But the lost cause myth matters because, as I said, it's part of a system with segregation laws, white terror, black disenfranchisement, Confederate monuments that forms pillars. It's the ideological foundation for a white supremacist society.
So let's just talk about the tail end of what you just addressed, which is the guy who is thought of as a masterful tactician and military operative is a loser. How did you look at that when you had such reverence for the man in your early life?
Yeah, it was the Army officer in me in many ways that I changed, because I served in the U.S. Army to defend the United States of America for more than 3 decades. And I came to revere, I love my country. But sometimes you have to criticize your country if you love it. That's kind of what James Baldwin says. So it took me a while. It took me too long, frankly, before I came to this realization that the hero that I had growing up, the values that he believed in were antithetical to everything that I believed in. And when I finally came to that realization, I knew that I had to talk about it. And my wife really gave me the courage to do that, because one day I was trying to prevent Confederates from going in our memorial hall at West Point. And everybody told me, the senior leader said, no, we want to bring people together. And I couldn't convince them that Lee and his people like him, which fought against their country, killed U.S. Army soldiers. And that was another thing that Lee did, for the worst possible reason, to create a slave republic, didn't represent our values. And she's the one that told me, Ty, you got to tell your story. You got to be vulnerable enough to be honest about who you are. And so once I started doing that, by telling my own story, I've had a little bit more effect on others.
So tell your story, you did. You graduated from Washington and Lee University, and then you go back after a distinguished career in the Army, retiring as a brigadier general, and you stand on the stage at your alma mater and say, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Robert E. Lee is a traitor. How does that go over?
Yeah, and not just a traitor, but a traitor for slavery. So he committed treason for slavery. And, the argument that I gave is that there's only one crime in the Constitution, and that is violating Section 3, Article 3, which is treason is levying war against the United States. I told that audience that there were 8 U.S. colonels from Virginia in 1861, and 7 of them stayed with the United States. And only Lee chooses treason. And why does he do it? He believed more firmly, profited more than any other Army officer by running enslaved labor farms or plantations. So when I gave that speech, oh my gosh, Joe, I was so nervous to do that, because I have a funny last name. I never had my son of a teacher. I never really had the status that many of the people had there, though I wanted it. But I had to tell my truth, and I'm actually framed. Behind me is the recumbent statue. Lee is literally the altar in that Lee Chapel.
Right.
And his picture is there, stage left. I mean, I was nervous. But what I found by telling my story is that you will believe this. I couldn't believe it, but they gave me a standing ovation.
Right.
And I even though I called Lee a traitor for slavery, standing above his grave. And that's when I realized that maybe by telling my story, I could have an effect. Now, listen, one speech doesn't change society. It doesn't change a college. But at least we can be more honest about who these people are and who we are if we're venerating them.
So how do we go beyond one speech? What do we need to do?
Well, I think the first thing is that the only way to prevent a racist future is to first acknowledge our racist past. So we have to be honest about what this lost cause myth is. And part of it is education. My home state of Virginia is now doing a wonderful job by teaching this so that they don't get the same thing I did. My first chapter book was Meet Robert E. Lee, which was just made him a saint. So luckily my kids didn't get that education. And if I ever get grandkids, which I don't have yet, but I'm working on, then if they get it, they won't get this education either. So it starts with education, but it also is a willingness for Americans to understand why we are like we are. And that is this racism that is, and it's, by the way, it's not just Southern. It goes from sea to shining sea. There are housing covenants in every city in America that were created in the 20th century to prevent black people from living in there. And so, it's an understand that our history is the first place to start. And then policies are going to have to change. But boy, I think the foundation is understanding where we are and why we are like we are today.
So what do you, we all had a visceral response, I think. We all had a response to what we saw that happened in our nation's capital on January 6th. For you, and after your many years, decades of service to this country, and given your truth that you are now speaking, what was it like to see not one but several Confederate flags being marched through the halls of the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, Joe, I was so livid. My wife and I were watching it on TV like so many Americans were. And to see the flag of treason, and that's what I call it, the flag of treason, flying inside the Capitol just made me livid. And I'll tell you one story about this. So everybody that's in that Capitol building that works there, everybody that works for the federal government takes an oath of office. And when I took my oath, I actually took it in Lee Chapel as a graduate of Washington Lee University, surrounded by Confederate flags. When I raised my right hand, I said I would promise to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I said I had no purpose of evasion. And everybody that was in that building, that Congress, took that oath. And that oath was written in 1862 as an anti-Confederate oath about people that were worried about treason, about Confederates taking over the federal government, about sneaking in to the Capitol through subterfuge. And in fact, as I saw that flag of treason, and you remember that guy had it on his back as he walked in,
right,
over his shoulder was a picture of Charles Sumner. Charles Sumner was nearly caned to death on the floor of the Senate because he excoriated enslavers. So in fact, the idea of political violence is as American as apple pie. No country is as developed country is as violent politically as we are. But as I saw that picture of Charles Sumner and the Confederate flag, Sumner's the one that wrote that oath that I took, that so many of us took to support the Constitution. It's an anti-Confederate oath, and yet there was that flag. So my reaction was visceral. And I tell you, I was ready. If the United States government needs an old soldier to go help put down sedition and insurrection, they can count on me, because this is the United States of America. And the purpose of the Constitution, when it was created, one purpose was to be able to put down rebellions. And that's what George Washington did. He went to the head of the column during the Whiskey Rebellion, put on his blue uniform as president to put down that rebellion. So, and then the next thing I think is that we must have, when it comes to this sedition, is that we must have, like everything else, accountability. We can't do forgiveness before we have accountability and truth.
So in both the causes that you just mentioned, in a manner of speaking, that's exactly what you are doing. I know you are limited in what you can say about this, but you have been named to the congressionally mandated commission on the naming of items in the Department of Defense that commemorate the Confederate States of America. So without getting into too much detail on that, as I realize it's new and it's all forming, and as I said, you're limited in what you can say, but what is the mission there, and what does it say that you, of course, yours is but one voice on that commission, but obviously you are brought into that conversation with them knowing what the words are behind that voice?
Well, Joe, I'm so honored to be asked to serve the nation again. And in fact, to serve on this commission, I recently had to raise my right hand and take that oath of office again. And I have given that oath to dozens of officers, maybe hundreds of cadets and officers over my course of my life. But it was so meaningful for me to raise my right hand and give that take that anti-Confederate oath. So the commission is there. It's a congressional. The law has been said that you know, to rename things after the Confederates in the Department of Defense. And I don't know how we're going to do that yet. I know I take that very seriously. But I will tell you, you know, just one part about, you know, who we've named these after, because I have written quite extensively about it. And if you look at like Fort Gordon, for instance, that's in Georgia, and it's a home of Army Signal and Cyber. And it's named after a guy, John Brown Gordon, who never served in the United States Army. And in fact, he founded the Ku Klux Klan, a white terror organization, and led it in Georgia. And he gave a speech to black Charlestonians where he said, if you black people are to demand equality, the 40 million of us white people will exterminate, that's the word he used, exterminate the 4 million of you in a race war. So we have these things named after a mishmash of really terrible people, terrible generals, and they were named during World War I and World War II when the Army and the South were racial police states. So, you know, I think the idea of that Congress, and by the way, it wasn't just a few congressional people that voted for this. It was a super majority of both House and Senate, which overrode President Trump's veto. And so we're going to listen to the communities as they're doing this. And I think the thing that I keep thinking about is to ensure that who we commemorate represents the values, diversity, and courage of the United States military, which represents our country. So I'm just so proud to be able to serve the nation again in something that I have expertise. And I think that's another great thing about that the current administration has done, which is they put people with real expertise on this panel. And the people that are my people on the commission are some of the most unbelievable people who have served the nation for decades and decades. So, again, I'm very, very honored to be on it.
And separate from that commission, I would assume you would hope that changes would take place on the very campus of West Point where you were a professor emeritus of history.
Yes. In fact, I know, having talked to the superintendent there and having led the memorialization committee there for a number of years, they can't wait to change. And I know the Army can't wait to change either. In fact, I'm so heartened by how the federal, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years ago when I was bringing the subject up, I mean, it was really hard for me to do it. And, you know, I couldn't do it, as a matter of fact. It was just too hot for the Army to handle. And for West Point, they didn't want to talk about it. That's no longer the case. They have thoroughly changed, and they want to change as soon as possible. So I certainly look forward to the day when I can go back to West Point, which I love dearly. You know, West Point's mission is to educate, train, and inspire leaders of character for the nation who live the values of duty, honor, country. I can't think of a better mission statement. But to go back on there and see things named for real heroes of America and not those who fought to destroy the country that I love, that so many of us love, it will be a dream for me. I'm really looking forward to that.
In our last few moments, you had to retire to ultimately allow yourself to speak out as you have.
Yes, I chose to retire. So, I mean, I didn't have to retire. I could have not written this book and stayed on active duty. But if I wanted to tell the truth that I saw, I couldn't do that in uniform. And there are a couple reasons for that. The first is, under the last administration, you know, you just couldn't do it. They weren't going to allow it, and they weren't going to even have any talk about it. That's the first reason. The second reason is that, you know, I didn't have full First Amendment rights. When you're in uniform, it was such an honor for me to serve. I'm so proud of my service. But you can't say what you want to say. And right now, being at Hamilton College, they are fully supportive of me using my First Amendment rights. Now, they say, go, Ty. You talk however you want to based on your research. I love it here at Hamilton College because they really allow me to do that. And you can't do that when you're in uniform. So I did choose to retire because one of the reasons I chose to retire is to be able to write this book and to speak freely and to be able to tell as many people as I can about what the Confederacy meant. It was about treason for slavery, and I think more people need to see it in that light. And I appreciate your allowing me to talk about this as well, because it does allow me a larger and louder voice than I would have had in uniform.
Well, and it all comes in that education that will hopefully propel change in the future. The name of the new book is Robert E. Lee and Me: A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Ty Sigilee is Professor Emeritus of History at West Point, as well as Chamberlain Fellow at Hamilton College, as well as New America Fellow. Ty Sigilee, what a great pleasure to have you on this program, a great honor as well. I thank you for your service, for your current work, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Joe, thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Robert E. Lee and Me, by Ty Sigilee. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.